Good morning. I'll call to order the Senate Education Committee. Today is Monday, February 13th, and the time is 8:05 a.m. In attendance are Co-Chair Senator Meyer, Vice Chair Senator Davis, Senator Stevens, and myself, Senator Thomas. We have a quorum to conduct business. I think Senator Hollis French is just arriving, fashionably late. Good morning, Hollis.
Good morning.
Welcome, everyone. First, is there any business to come before the committee? Seeing none, we have one item of business before us today. We'll hold the first hearing on SB 194. This is a long bill, and today we will basically go through it so we can get a little better feel, or you can get a better, little better feel of what exactly is covered in it. We did originally schedule two other bills for this week. However, we want to make sure that we give SB 194 a full hearing. We will take as much time as necessary this week on that one. In 2008, the legislature added intervention guidelines, partly because of the Moore case. We heard a report on the Moore case just this past Friday from Charles Wolfert and Commissioner Hanley. Since the Moore case was filed, the Department of Education has intervened in five school districts. Three of those are still in intervention status. It is time to look back on that process and see what was learned. The House has been hearing HB 256, essentially repeals the intervention process. SB 194 does more to refine the process by collaboration between local communities, districts, and the department. It enlarges the scope of audits done by the department for low-performing schools and sets up governance councils, guidance on the verge of intervention. These were some of the issues we heard about as we discussed the intervention with different districts and personnel from those districts, as well as from the department. We believe that repealing the statute would be a mistake, especially since having intervention guidelines are a requirement to get a waiver for No Child Left Behind. My aide, Murray Richmond, will come to walk through the bill. Also, Les Morse and Cynthia Curran from the department are here today and can answer questions that may arise about current practices. We expect to take public testimony on the bill on Wednesday. Murray, if you please come forward, put yourself on the record, and walk us through the bill.
Okay. My name is Murray Richmond, and I'm aide for Senator Thomas and co-aide for the Senate Education Committee. In January of last year, there were two petitions, or two, I'm not sure the formal terms, but the plaintiffs and the department had filed status updates on the Moore case. Reading the department's update, you were impressed by the amount of work that they did. They had been reaching out to the districts. They had been working on curriculum. It was a full document full of work that they had been doing in the intervention districts. But then reading the plaintiff's case, it was like they were just not connecting. There was a lot of work done, but not necessarily the work that needed to be done. And I guess that's the impetus for this bill, is to create those connections. It's a fairly straightforward bill, even though it's a fairly long bill. Section 1, and I'm going to just walk through it section by section. If you have questions, you can stop and ask as you go. In Section 1, we set up schools can be designated as a low-performing school or district, and it gives the department the ability to designate a school as low-performing. They have standards by which they do that. That would be based on the assessments, based student assessments that are being done, graduation rates and things like that, so they can designate a school as low performing. Section 2 says that low performing will essentially mean the bottom 3% according to their accountability standards, and 3% was chosen because those are the schools that will come under all the things that are going to happen in this bill. I talked with the department about different numbers. We talked 5%, 3%. 3% is roughly 17 schools, and so they would be focusing roughly on 17 schools at any given time. A school can move out of that designation or drop back into it, and so it would be a current, hopefully schools would be moving down as other schools got better, and as the schools got better, then other schools would be in place to have some improvements going on. So most of the things that would happen for the bottom 3%.
Chairman, just a question.
Sure.
On that.
Thanks.
Senator French. While we're here, because it is a lengthy bill, and it may be a while before we get back to it. I take it that means an individual school building to be a school.
Through the chair, that is correct.
So if you have a high school, middle school, grade school, those are three schools. But if they're all combined into one in a community, it's one.
Through the chair, that is also correct.
And how does it account for charter schools?
I think that would, they would also, through the chair, that would also be included in that. I am not aware of how charter schools come under the assessment process, and perhaps Deputy Commissioner Morse could answer that question better than I could.
He's nodding his head yes so far anyhow, and indicating probably that he's certainly willing to let us know just how charter schools are considered.
Could you clarify?
Turner Stephen.
I'm not clear. Senator French's question, you said if three schools, elementary, middle, and high school were in the same building, then all three would be considered as one, so all three would be considered needing improvement, or just because there are three principals, right?
I, through the chair, I believe there would be one principal of those schools, but I, again, I would defer to the department on that.
There seemed to indicate yes again.
That there would be one principal. Okay. Yeah, my understanding is that a school is an autonomous function and may incorporate more than one grade, but the principal would be in charge of the students in that school, not subsections. They, and most of them would be smaller schools.
Mr. Morse, maybe you should come forward and sit aside Murray.
Yeah, maybe I can clarify. I know specifically in the Kodiak school, the high school and middle school and elementary school are all attached. Or maybe just the high school and the middle school have two separate principals, I believe. So maybe you can clarify that.
And that's the kindergarten deck we have here. So
Perfect. For the record, my name is Les Morse. I'm the Deputy Commissioner at the Alaska Department of Education Early Development. I heard two questions. I'll start with yours, so through the chair, Senator Stevens. School configuration is really a function of how the district categorizes their schools and less about the buildings. So the buildings might be attached, but they may have considered it one school. For example, many of our smaller rural schools are K-12 schools with one principal, but there are some that are K-8 and then a high school. Physically, the buildings are attached, but there may be two separate principals, and they classify them as two separate schools. Generally, if there's a principal, a general rule would be that it's probably a building and considered a school of itself. But we have K-12 schools. We have K-6s and K-5s. We have 6-8s. We have high schools that are traditionally 9-12, but there are many different configurations. So it really, again, is a function of what the district classifies them and how they group the grades and the staffing around that.
Is that helpful?
That is issue, and I want to make sure I do understand it. So if you have a middle school and a high school in the same building, actually the same building, two principals. The high school was doing really well. The middle school was not. Middle school would be declared, whatever the term is, needing help anyway.
Low performing.
The high school would not be then.
Through the chair, Senator Thomas, under my understanding of this piece of legislation, you are absolutely correct.
Okay. And we'd like to hear that absolutely correct. We really do.
No, we're absolutely.
I think they're 8 in the morning.
I can say something absolutely every now and then. Could I go ahead and make sure I address the charter school question?
Certainly.
As well?
Please.
And I just want to confirm that through the chair, Senator French, charter schools are really treated the same way in Alaska as our other public schools. So they participate in all the testing, as do other schools, and this law would apply to them. The way we read the legislation, the same as it would any other school.
Thank you. And just to accentuate that, all schools are given the same standard tests to determine their performance level and determine whether they're low performing or not.
Chair Thomas, that's absolutely correct. We have the same rules for all public schools, and in Alaska, charter schools are public schools.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Just one follow-up, if I could, Mr. Chairman.
Sure.
Back up one page on the page one.
Oh, jeez.
Well, you know, you just got to, you know,
okay,
get bedrock, then we can go forward at a much faster pace. But the first line six of the bill says a public school or district that's designated low-performing. Maybe you can elaborate on how that might shake out, where you've got three or four schools in a district, some good, some bad, but the district overall rates low performing.
Certainly, Mr. Morse, yeah, and I realize we had five, and you might explain just a little bit about that, give people a little better concept of how we arrived at the five to begin with, maybe.
Through the chair, Senator French, our understanding when it says school or district meant that really we have to look at both. So you have to look at all these conditions and how we rank the districts as a whole and the schools. So I believe the percent throughout is 3%. So in this case, for a district, we have 53 districts, 54 when we include Mount Edgecombe Boarding School. So you're talking...
Are they separate categories then? Low-performing school, low-performing district, or is it low-performing school or district? See what I mean?
Well, through the chair, Senator French, actually the way we read it, and that will help in the hearing to really clarify how you want the legislation to move forward. But we looked at it as we had to do two calculations. We had to take a look at districts, and if there was a district that overall is performing at that low level, then there may need to be, this bill may apply to that district as a whole. But in the scope of things, we're probably going to have one or two, because it's 1.5 when you do the math. So it would be one or two districts in that category, but likely it means it would be very unlikely that their schools, or very many of their schools within them, are doing well either, and they may be a duplicate same listing. And then another calculation on the schools, which then ends up with 17 schools. So you could, the way we're reading it is it could be one or two districts and 17 schools under the current number of schools and districts that we have.
I guess I'll leave it to the administration to see how this shakes out, but it just seems like you could come up with some odd configurations or some odd designations. I guess I'll think about it a little bit more.
But you will go through the you will go through the schools as well as the district, and probably you'll be able to sort out individual schools if in fact their test scores and stuff are above the minimum performance needed to classify them as low performing.
Senator Thomas, that's exactly correct. Okay. Yes, we'd be able to do that.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Davis.
Since you stopped at this point, do you have a definition for low-performing schools? I don't see one in the bill. What is there one in the statute that says what's a low-performing school?
Through the chair, Senator Davis, the statute actually refers to another section in statute where we do have a way to rank schools where we use what's required by ESEA so that we have one system out there for evaluating schools.
So there is a definition. What is the definition for a low performing school?
Through the chair, Senator Davis, what we do is use adequate yearly progress, and then we further look at things within that by taking a look at whether they have growth indicating that even though they're not meeting adequate yearly progress, the school is improving and is on its path to meeting adequate yearly progress. So we take a look at adequate yearly progress, which comes from their test scores, and then their growth, which also comes from their test scores, but it is a different look than AYP.
Is that the statute?
Yeah, correct.
Through the chair, you have the statute that deals with how they make those determinations as part of your packet. It's statute 1403.123.
And it's the last couple of pages in the packet, although I think it may not be as definitive as to Senator Davis's question, the specifics of it, which are more in regulation, I'm assuming, and some other.
Yeah.
I've made note of it, and we don't have to hold up any longer.
Okay.
We could just go through the bill.
Okay, great. Thank you. Please proceed.
You want to stay?
You might as well stay.
It's probably a good idea. Moving on to Section 3, this is where we get to what happens when a school is defined as a low-performing school. In Section 3, it gives measures that the department can take for low-performing schools. Number one, supply the school or district with a person who is training and experienced in education. This is essentially education coaches. And that, in talking with people throughout the intervention process, almost everyone agrees that the coaches have been a good idea. And some would say that's been one of the best things that has come out of the intervention process. And so number one refers to coaches. Number two refers to the finances, provide an operations audit to identify possible programmatic savings and review the manner in which financial resources are being directed. The department already does a desk audit, and this gives them the ability to do that and to do it even more in depth. One of the things that came out in the 2007 Moore order, the judge wrote, the evidence at trial also indicates that neither of the legislature finance committees have undertaken a review as to how the school districts are spending the state funds appropriated to them. Judge Gleason was very concerned that there was no financial oversight of what was going on in the districts, and this would provide some financial oversight. Number three also provides financial oversight, and this would be to the school boards, especially concerning state and federal funds. Number four, they can provide incentives for highly qualified teachers or principals. There's a possible monetary incentive that has been discussed. There's the opportunity of using something like Teachers for America, Teach for America, or some program like that, but they would be directed to find some way to attract highly qualified people coming up. Number five, provide additional training and technical assistance for parents and guardians of children. This recognizes that community involvement is crucial to school success. If parents are not involved, you have a much smaller chance in the classroom. As to teacher training, you cannot have too much teacher training in this changing world. We do a lot of in-service, and some of the in-service, I'm sure, is helpful. This year, we passed a bill on the need for suicide prevention for in-service training, and so that would continually be updated. And given that many of our teachers come from outside of Alaska to be trained on what it's like to function within a rural district in Alaska or even an urban district in Alaska, the difference is there, they would be more effective. Targeted resources for graduation success. This is actually part of the Moore settlement. This is number six. If a significant group is not passing the high school graduating qualifying exam, they can get some extra help on that. And Moore directs that help currently. Direct the school board, number seven, direct the school board to identify model curriculum, including recommended textbooks, materials, and supplies. Districts are not told which curriculums to use, but they're directed to perhaps identify more appropriate curriculums. We are not taking away local control in this of the school districts, but at the same time, there's a sense of oversight over the curriculum where someone's saying, I'm not sure this is the best curriculum. Can you find something better? Curriculum was also an issue in the Moore case. Judge Gleason wrote in one place, the plaintiff has persuasively argued that if each small school district is expected to select its own curriculum and align that curriculum to state standards, there needs to be considerable greater technical support provided to each district. And this particular section allows for technical support. One of the major complaints from the plaintiffs was that they were directed towards curriculum but did not necessarily get the support they needed to put that curriculum in place. And this would direct the department to do that. Work with the local school board to develop and implement a plan to address deficits in achievement and learning environments. This empowers the department to work with local school boards. And the department, there will be an audit, which you'll see in the next section, and there will be a lot of data coming out of that. And the department will be there to, as kind of ombudsman, or to explain some of the data for folks that perhaps aren't used to dealing with statistical data or are trying to find what this means in terms of overall school performance around the state. Number nine, assign a technical assistance team to a school or a district. This would be similar to the coaches, but instead of one person, you might have a team of people coming in and working with the district. Number 10, establish instructional and learning environment benchmarks for schools or districts to meet as it progresses towards the removal of designation of low performing. Tell a school you're down here, you need to be up here, it would be helpful sometimes to have some benchmarks along the way. you know, if you're meeting this year, and the department that has the expertise can provide realistic benchmarks so schools can measure their performance as they're moving along. You know, it may be that on some measures you don't see some success for a while, others you should see it right away, and the department could supply that expertise. Direct the establishment of learning cohorts in school that require continuous monitoring of student performance. This is both for students and for teachers. Working in isolation can be somewhat daunting. I had a friend who was teaching and was basically thrown into a classroom and really didn't know what to do. And when he reached out for other teachers, he wasn't given much help. Sometimes gathering students in cohorts can help. But this would be if we're having a problem where we're putting teachers in classrooms and they're not getting the support, the department could come in and look and say, you know, you need to have a regular support time for your teachers. Provide better training to school boards, to the Alaska Association of School Boards. Obviously, the better functioning the school board is, then the more chance that school has for success. Under I of this section,
certainly, Senator Stevens.
Before you go on, are we seeing any change in the way this is worded to the requirements or responsibilities of school boards? And maybe it's just the way things are now, and maybe it's making no change. But, you know, I'm looking at things like the school boards being responsible for approving textbooks. You know, I spent 3 years at a school board, and I don't recall our doing that. I mean, I think we depended on the experts, the teachers, and the administration. Do you see this as any change to what you're asking of school districts, of school boards?
Through the chair, again, Les Morse, Deputy Commissioner at the Department of Education. Through the chair, Senator Stevens, I think in some districts it may in fact be a change. Under the statute's curriculum, which is a real good example, I think, for us to use, under statute it says that curriculum is a local function, and therefore our view at the department is that at some point the board would adopt that. They probably depend on their local expertise, though, to do sort out what's a good curriculum, those kinds of things. And when you adopt the curriculum, usually either within that or as an appendium to that is the textbook series or those kinds of things that are going to support that. So I think this does change things because it heightens that and makes it capture the attention of those local boards because and it's a fairly important instructional issue for them to think about. However, I do know some boards really dig into that level of detail. In a district I once worked in, the board was very involved in going through the textbook. So I think that's different in different districts right now, and this would probably cause that to occur in more districts where it might not.
Okay. Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just curious, how did we come up with this 12-step program? Is it modeled after another school district in another state?
These were gleaned from what had been occurring in legislation in the states of Michigan, Connecticut, Texas, and North Carolina.
Okay.
So I did a survey of what schools have been doing for what legislatures have been doing for reform programs around, and this is going through all those, these seem to be the ones that were most appropriate for Alaska.
Okay, and Mr. Chairman, I'm assuming that then we're open to making changes or adjustments to this 12-step. It looks good. It looks very comprehensive, but I was just curious as to how we came up with this.
So. Through the chair, the reason we're going through this in such detail is to find those changes and places where it needs to be changed so it is the best possible bill for Alaska's children. So
excellent. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You're welcome. Thank you. Please proceed.
Section I concerns the audit. Audit can be a scary word. The intent of the audit is to be able to provide information for the districts so they can function. For the 2 years following a designation of a school as a low-performing school, the department shall contract to have an external team come in and do an academic performance audit of the district and the local low-performing school. The department already does something similar to that. They do an annual desk audit, and biannual?
Annual
desk audit. And then for low-performing schools, there's an additional audit that takes place. The audit that is lined out in this section takes into account the six areas that are already being audited. And in Section J below, you see what those six areas are: curriculum, assessment, instruction, learning environment, professional development, and leadership. And those are six prime areas for the audit. It adds areas also that may or may not impinge on student performance, and those are delineated down below. Student graphics, that could include the number of students on free or reduced lunch, overall academic patterns in the district, number of high school graduates in the community, things that would affect. And if, for instance, we know if we have a lot of students on free lunch, that district probably will not be performing as well, and there may be other issues that need to be addressed. Mobility patterns, you know, when are kids in school, when are they not in school? If hunting season is a major issue in a school or a district, let's take that into account somehow. That's not necessarily saying we bow to what's going on, but to take it into account. School feeder patterns. In larger districts, are the schools lumping all their underprivileged kids into one school? In which case, you know, you're creating a laboratory for failure. Strategic allocation of resources. You know, are the smart students getting more resources and the underprivileged students getting less? You know, how are resources being allocated? High standards and expectations for all students. And I know this is a very simple phrase we can all agree to, but in one sense it's perhaps one of the more controversial parts. Are we going to expect our students to do better, or are we going to lower standards to what we think our students can obtain? And this would, you know, what are our standards for learning among the various schools that our kids are in? High level of collaboration and learning. Is that going on in the districts? Is it like my friend who's stuck alone in a classroom? Right now, Finland is one of the rages, and they have some things we can learn from, but one of the things they do there is that they focus on all the children in the school. And for instance, in my own experience, in fourth grade, I had teachers compare notes and were wondering why I had really strange performance, and through that comparison, they figured out I needed glasses. Not one teacher alone was able to make that designation, but all of them together were able to decide, oh, you know, when he works at the board, he can't see anything, but at his desk, he's great. And had my eyes tested in fourth grade, had a significant change to my life. Frequency of monitoring of learning and teaching. You know, are teachers being monitored? Do we know how they're performing? We don't want to go overboard on this. Tennessee introduced a radical monitoring piece of legislation, and their principals are complaining that they have no time to be principals. They have to be in the classrooms monitoring teachers all the time. So we don't want to go that far. But are the teachers being monitored? High level of family and community involvement. Alternative secondary schools best practices. This would be charter schools. And are there any unique circumstances or characteristics of the school or district, including substance abuse and other social factors? We know that Alaska ranks towards the top on a lot of things that we'd rather be at the bottom at: domestic abuse, substance abuse, suicide, things like that. If an area is impacted by suicide, that will affect how the students in that area learn.
Senator French.
Yeah, just on these factors, I guess I just have a little quibble with the grammar here. It's not clear to me how how someone examines. I mean, I know how you examine student demographics. I know how you examine mobility patterns. I don't know how you examine high standards and expectations for all students. I don't know how you examine high level of collaboration and communication. I know what you mean, but don't you want to say the degree of or just the standards and expectations? Examine them. Examine the degree of collaboration and communication. Examine the degree of family and community involvement. I guess I don't quite get how 5, 6, and 8 add up grammatically here.
Through the chair, we can come back with clarifying language on that.
Thank you.
And finally, that audit will be made available to the district, to the audited school district and staff, the local community, and the Board of Education Early Development. So all affected parties would have access to the audit. Section 4.
I think in some of this, Senator French, some of these things came about just through the Moore case and other things, you know, as far as what was expected. There were also complaints that these things didn't exist, and some of the communities wanted to have more input, and some of the, not necessarily the language, but the concepts, like you said, are all things we'd like to see. How we accomplish them is the difficult part. So we're just trying to make sure that all of the things that have been brought up as issues are at least a starting point for us here as we try and massage those into maybe better language or something that seems more meaningful or more attainable.
Yeah, I think they're great factors. I just, you know, just a little bit of a language, you know, massage, and it'll be clear what the job is.
Okay, great. Thanks. Proceed.
Okay. In Section 4, this establishes a process by which the local community can have a say in the revitalization of their school district. Section A establishes a revitalization school or district, and we went back and forth on the language that could be used, renovation, but people thought that was more building-oriented. Revitalization sounds, and rather than an intervention district necessarily, that the district is intervening in these schools, it's a revitalization process. If a school has gone 3 consecutive years of being a low-performing school without improvement, the department shall designate that school or district as a revitalization school or district. They will continue to identify that school or district until they're taken off. In other words, once a school gets its way onto the list, it's going to have to earn its way off of the list. Assist the local school board with developing and implementing an revitalization plan, and maintain the eligibility of the school or district for available federal funds and state aid. Also, in talking with superintendents, one of them in particular suggested that there be a way for superintendents to be able to collaborate in some sense. Number 5 establishes a superintendent cohort made up of the superintendent of the revitalization district, or, and we might need to clarify this language, superintendent of a district where they have revitalization schools, along with at least 2 other superintendents who are in similar districts but not in revitalization status, and so they would be a learning cohort together.
Just on that point,
Senator French,
Mr. Chairman, I like this idea. I'm just a little concerned about some of the strain it may put on superintendents. I just will guess that many of these schools are going to be rural schools, going to be hard to get to and into and out of, and I just wonder about the travel cost and the travel time. And the sort of drain of attention from other districts in meeting this idea. We just want to decide what regularly means, you know, whether it means once, twice, or every month. It's just something I'm flagging for future consideration.
Mm-hmm. Through the chair, later they'll have to issue a report after 9 months.
I see that. I'm just not sure how many times they're going to meet, and I guess that means 2 other superintendents are going to leave their school districts, get on planes, fly to a rural area, spend a day there. You can't go for less than a day unless you land in, you know, and you know how it is. And so it's just, I'm just a little worried about the use of resources, the wise use of resources.
Through the chair, it might be helpful to hear from other superintendents. This came as an idea from one of the superintendents who wasn't in intervention status.
Right.
So,
you know, I totally get the idea that he wants support from his peer group, and they may be able to offer suggestions that sort of no one else understands. It's a good idea. I'm just a little worried about how it gets implemented.
Mm-hmm. B, a school or district that has not been designated as a revitalization school or district may request the establishment of a governance council, and we'll get to what governance councils are in just a second. Basically, this says you don't have to wait until you're in such bad trouble that the department has to come in and tell you you're in trouble. But if a superintendent can see the handwriting on the wall, they can actually request the process. So for school districts that feel like they need some help, they need community involvement, they need some help from the department. They can come in and request that help.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Stevens.
I'm really concerned about this part of it, and the following portion, which deals with a governance council. In effect, what we're doing is ripping away the responsibility of an elected school board. The public has elected the school board, and if the school says, not the school board, but if the school says we need help, it's not put upon the school board to solve the problem. All of their responsibility is taken away from them, and we now have a governance council. I would suggest that a school board is a governance council. I don't really see why we need to take the responsibility away from elected officials and create a separate entity here. In fact, doing away with the school board, am I right? This really does mean that the school board no longer functions as a school board. All power is taken away from them into this governance council. Do I understand that correctly?
Through the chair, the board appoints the governance council.
But the board doesn't ask for the governance council.
That is correct.
And B, the district says would request a governance council, having nothing to do with the board.
Yes, that is.
I think this needs careful thought. Our history as a people for 200 years has been based on our elected representation, and what you're doing in these few pieces of this bill is just demolishing that and replacing it. I think we need to be very, very cautious what we're doing here, and I'd appreciate hearing from others about it. If I'm wrong, I'm wrong, but it just seems to me that it is going absolutely against our history of public education.
Through the chair, the intent is not to demolish our standards of election, but to provide in districts where things are not working new ways for things to work. These are four low-performing districts, and either something needs to change in these districts if there's going to be change for the students.
I understand that, but I'm saying that the public elects the school board, elects the management, elects what decisions will be made, the people who make those decisions. This is a revolutionary thought, it seems to me, that we find in this bill. Anyway, appreciate hearing more about it as we go along.
Through the chair, the background of this is talking with people who work in the districts and on the ground and would like support from parents, teachers, the people they work with. And respectfully, they do not feel like they are always getting that.
Well, and so we have the ballot box in which you elect a new school board if you don't like the current one.
That is absolutely correct, sir.
And I think some of this also came from the idea that the school boards, and I'm not speaking for all of them, I think they found that they were lacking in the ability to actually understand and implement some of the changes, so that it was tried to work in conjunction with them, allowing them to appoint some of that committee anyhow to make sure that their thoughts were still there, but they were, and I think we're looking at information from those particular non-performing school districts where people just said we lack the knowledge of education to begin with to put together a system that's working. We're trying, we've worked at it, but it's not like we just sat here and let our school kind of get in a position of being a non-performing school, so we need some help, and although I understand your point, those people were elected, but we're hoping that through their concern they will pick some people to help them in the community to increase that. People that are interested in the school but may be busy but at that point in time are encouraged to get involved. So we don't want to just rip it out of their hands. There's no doubt of that, and maybe the language appears that it is, but that's not the intent anyhow. So we're trying to work with them and hopefully involve them in the process, obviously.
May I ask the Senator a clarifying question?
Sure.
Were you referring that comment to just B or to the whole concept of governance council?
The whole concept, really.
Okay.
What if we were to establish a governance council over the legislature, throw them all out,
and have a bunch of people who are experts in the field make these decisions instead of the legislature. I mean, it does fly in the face of democracy, it seems to me. Anyway, I'll drop that. And
no, we will take note of that.
You get a black on that.
Senator French, you had a question?
It's along the same lines as Senator Stevens. It's a fascinating sort of potential clash, really, between a governance council and a school board. And I'm reading ahead also about how you sort of manage that, manage the coexistence of two bodies, both given the same job of governing a school district. And I just think we need to spend a fair amount of time giving it serious thought as to how, I mean, I get your point. You've got to have sort of a fresh set of eyes and a fresh blood taking over a very problematic school district. On the other hand, maybe it's not the school board's fault. Maybe the school board, you know, has been working as hard as it can, and suddenly it's got this new group that may be in conflict with it. So I'll be reading very carefully. Thank you.
Good. Thank you.
I will continue. I'm hoping that part of C will answer part of this. A local school board that governs a school district that's been designated as revitalization shall establish the governance council, and the school board will appoint, it will be appointed by the local school board. It was suggested by one of the people I talked to that it not just be the local school board, but it be more like a subcommittee of the school board. It would consist of four parents or guardians of the school board attending the school. They would be nominated by parents or guardians of the school, but again appointed by the school board. Four community leaders residing with the school district, nominated by the members selected under 1 and 3, the parents and the teachers. And again, if we wanted to make this more of a subset of the school board, we could change the way that these people are appointed to that. One representative from the department, 1 to 4 principals of the school and the district, or the principal's designees, and the superintendent of the district, or a representative of the superintendent cohort established under number 5 of this. If a district is a smaller district, and they can't get this many people, there's allowances in D for smaller districts to have a smaller governance council. And then E, the terms shall be 2 years, and no member shall serve no more than 2 terms on the council. So they serve without compensation, but they get per diems. Then we get into what the governance council shall do. A governance council shall, in conjunction with the department and the superintendent cohort, and at this point, given the concerns, I think we would add school board.
Senator Stevens,
An F, responsibilities and duties of the governance council, where it says, a governance council shall, in conjunction with the department and the superintendent cohort established under this section, we could add school board to that so that they are more a functioning subcommittee of the school board.
I would think that would be advisable.
Analyze the school data that's been given through the audit. They'll need help from the different parts to understand this data, probably. Meet with and review the report of the district superintendent cohort. We can define what's in that report or not, but they would hear from the superintendent after confirming with other superintendents what they feel needs to be addressed in the district. Participate in the hiring process of the school principal or other administrators of the schools by conducting interviews of the candidates and reporting the results of the interviews to the superintendent of the schools for the school districts and the local school board. I realize the concerns with this. One of the intents of this is to involve parents and community members in all processes of this. I have heard in Fairbanks that when they do interview local teachers, local principals, there's often not a lot of community support for those. And again, this involves more people in the community in some of those decisions. Assist the principal of the school in making programmatic and operational changes to improve the school's achievement, including adjustments in program school hours, days of operation and enrollment goals for the school, work with the school administration to develop and approve a school compact for parents and guardians and students. The parents would work together and the teachers to develop a compact for parents and the community. There are some places where parents, immigrant families, for instance, are not quite clear on what it means to be the parent of a school child. In the Moore 2007 case, Judge Gleason said the importance of both family and community to the educational process was recognized by many witnesses throughout the trial. Problems with absenteeism, drug and alcohol abuse, lack of community support, and other factors are often beyond the control of the school. But as Bill Bjork testified, the absence of an engaged parent can't be an educational death sentence for this student. They would develop and approve a written parental involvement policy that outlines the roles of parents and legal guardians in the school. If the government's counsel determines it necessary to recommend intervention by the department, work with the department to develop an intervention plan for the school involving available regional, local, and statewide resources. In other words, if the government's counsel has got in and they found out that they're way over their heads and that this cannot be fixed, they can recommend an intervention to the appropriate bodies. And number eight, prepare a revitalization model that takes into account recommendations consistent with duties 1 through 7 in this section. Other options available to the Governance Council, they may review the draft describing, and the statute, it refers to in 1403.120, basically says a district shall annually file with the department and make available to the public a report that establishes district goals and priorities for improving education, includes a plan for achieving district goals and priorities, and includes a means of measuring the achievement of district goals and priorities. And the Governance Council would review the goals of the administration and provide advice to the principals of the schools before filing that. Assist the principal of the schools in developing a revitalization plan before the plan is submitted to the superintendent of schools. And I'm assuming by the superintendent that they do work with the school boards in the areas that they are. That model may be different in other areas. I'm going from what I know in the Fairbanks model, but the superintendent does work with the school boards in that. On issues related to school climate and conditions. Number four, provide advice to the principal of the school on any other major policy matters affecting the school, except on matters relating to collective bargaining. If there's issues that the Governance Council feels needs to be addressed other than collective bargaining, they can provide advice. A local school board in conjunction with the department shall provide appropriate training and instruction to the members of the Governance Council to aid them in the execution of their duties. So the boards will be involved in training the members of the Governance Council. After a revitalization plan has been developed, then what happens? Not later than 30 days after the Governance Council informs the board of the completion of the revitalization model, the local school board shall hold a public hearing to discuss the model and shall at the next regularly scheduled meeting conduct a vote to accept the model recommended by the Governance Council. The school board has appointed the council. They have a member on it. They can require regular reporting. Hopefully they will not be surprised by any initiatives that the Governance Council would be taking. If the local school board selects an alternative model, they can always reject the model. Not later than 10 days after the vote of the school board, the board shall meet with the Governance Council to discuss what that model is like. If the school board receives a report and says, yeah, this, and this, but we also need to look at this and this, they can request further work on it. If they can't agree, after 45 days, the department shall decide whether to adopt the council's model or the local school board's alternative revitalization model. And so the department would make that. They would have two out there and would make that designation. If the local school board votes to maintain the current school status, if they decide that no changes need to be made, the department shall decide whether to implement the revitalization model. And this would probably be, given comments made before, perhaps somewhat alarming, and that the department could trump a local school board on that. And I am starring that to revisit that issue. And then after 2 years, after revitalization model, the department shall do reports based on, you know, is it working? This would be research-based, and they would look at the revitalization model adopted by the school, the numbers and types of disciplinary incidents, the number of truants, the dropout rate, school attendance rate, average scale scores on the statewide secondary school graduation qualifying exam, number of students completing advanced placement work, teacher retention rate, and the existence and size of a parent-teacher organization for the school. And then there's a sunset. This would be reported on or before July 1 of each odd number year. The department shall report to the standing committees of the legislature having jurisdiction over education. That would be this committee. The number of governance councils that have been set, a comparison of the governance councils, which ones worked and which didn't, whether parental involvement has increased at these places or not. And then Section 5 establishes a sunset clause. And so this would go to January 1, 2018.
Thank you, and I realize, and I had some reaction to many of the tenants in this section, but also after sitting and listening to what was taking place in some of the districts, the low-performing districts, it became apparent that there was a need for, you know, somewhat radical change. And then the Moore case came up with a variety of suggestions and things that need to take place. So I think this is at least a starting point to see where we are. And I realize it's fairly dramatic, but when you look at what was taking place in the five districts and two coming out of it and what it took, this doesn't necessarily mirror everything that took place, but it does put in place many of the things that they realized on their own needed to be done. And it sounds somewhat dictatorial, obviously, but there was need for it because it was just an ugly situation that led to lawsuits. So things did need to change. So it's a fairly dramatic change, but we're willing to take any kind of advice people have, and we might get some information from the district as to their thoughts on it and why some of the things that are contained in the bill are important or they see important in revitalizing districts. And with that, I'm going to pass the gavel over. If people want to stick around and spend a little more time or not, I lost track. It was so fascinating, I lost track of the time myself, and it's almost 9 o'clock, and I need to be in another meeting. So,
I think you can adjourn.
You can adjourn?
Okay.
Unless any last comments, Mr. Morris, the department, we'll have more opportunity for you to comment basically on that particular section, which seemed to draw a lot of attention. So we'll look forward to doing that on Wednesday. And if there's nothing else to come before the committee, we are adjourned.